It's a real honor to be here speaking in the same session with such great speakers as Jeremy and Dr. Lin and Dr. Robbins. For those of you who don't know, Dartmouth College is it's on the border of New Hampshire and Vermont, about halfway between Montreal and Boston. Today I'm going to be talking about something that's come up. Jeremy briefly mentioned it in his talk. Using longitudinal variables for the purpose or the sole purpose of capturing better information about survival. And this is particularly relevant for a clinical trial with a survival endpoint. I just have to get familiar with this keyboard here. What key do I push to go forward? Okay. Down arrow? Okay. Okay, so I'm going to give you some background and a brief review of a few of the methods that have been used. What's called weighting inversely proportional to probability of censoring, which is from Dr. Jamie Robbins. Weighted Kaplan-Meier's, which is from Susan Murray and Butch Teatis. And multiple imputation, which is in part from Dr. Taylor when he worked with Dr. Fawcett. And describe the approach that I've used and worked on, and talk about some potential gains in efficiency in clinical trials where you to incorporate these auxiliary variables. And then with a couple questions that I have. So again, the setting is a clinical trial comparing two or more arms, and the primary endpoint is a time to event. The typical toolbox that we all learn and epidemiologists learn for analyzing data like this is the use of Kaplan-Meier curves and log rank tests or other two-sample statistics, and calculating hazard ratios using Cox's model. And in all these approaches, we use the partial information from censored subjects. So for subjects that are censored, we use the information that their survival time exceeds their observed follow-up time. And the challenge here is, what about the extra information that you can garner from about survival from prognostic clinical variables or longitudinal variables that are measured post-randomization? They might also be measured at baseline, but we're not certainly not going to incorporate that so much. It's the post-randomization values of these longitudinal variables which is relevant. So examples in oncology, survival might be the primary endpoint, but you might be looking at the size of a tumor at 6 months after beginning a treatment. In HIV studies, you might look at viral load at 6 months or a year after beginning of treatment. And to give you an idea here is what we're getting at, so suppose patient one, who's in treatment arm, he's alive at the end of the study, and his tumor's reduced. As contrasted against another patient, patient two, who's in the placebo arm, is alive at the end of the study, but his tumor has doubled in size. So how can we capture that information? So the available information now is that you have your partial information on survival, and you have your longitudinal variable, which I'm going to use a Z or Z to represent. So Z or Z, and I'm Canadian, but I work in the States, so I always get confused now. Z is the longitudinal prognostical variant measured post-randomization. And can we and how do we incorporate this additional information about survival to provide more powerful tests and less variable estimators? So some of the possible solutions, some of the knee-jerk reactions that people have when they first hear the problem is that throw it in the model as a covariate. And that's not a good idea, which I'll explain if it's not already apparent. Create a composite outcome. So an outcome which combines information on whether they survived or not with the covariate information. And I'll give you a reason why I don't like that. And another popular alternative in the past was to use this longitudinal variable as a surrogate, for me that's not the solution either. So why would you not want to include the model as regret include the covariate include the Z as a covariate in the in your regression model. If that's for those who have a knee-jerk reaction to do that, well, it's certainly not the thing to do, because then you'd be adjusting for a covariate measured post-randomization, and that's not what we want to do, because that would be removing the effect of treatment that is through survival. So that's a bad idea. So we have treatment, and we're looking at the effect of treatment on survival. Some of the effect of treatment might actually be through Z, whether indirectly or indirectly, but if you were to adjust out the effect of SED, you might be left with no effect at all. It's just the wrong thing to do, to throw it in as a covariate. Composite outcomes, these have become popular. I've noticed in clinical trials lately that these are becoming popular to combine endpoints into a composite outcome. So why would you not combine survival with the longitudinal covariate? Well, for me the question is just how would you weight, you know, those respective factors, and number two, survival is the primary endpoint, so don't compromise. Keep survival as the primary endpoint. So I don't want to do that. Go that route. Surrogate outcomes. This is tempting, especially if survival is highly censored. It's really very tempting, and it's been done in the past. But it's difficult, if not impossible, to verify that a variable is actually a surrogate in the sense of the definition that Prentice put down, that whereby the effect of treatment on survival is strictly through the surrogate. It's really hard to verify that. So I don't think that's the approach, and nor have other people who have worked on this problem. So I like to think of the longitudinal variant as an auxiliary variable. So what does that mean? It's an auxiliary variable is a variable that combines information to inference about the primary variables of interest without being of primary interest itself. So it's just there to be helpful. You're not going to draw inference on it. You could, but to the end of drawing inference on survival, survival is the focus. And the longitudinal variant is only there to provide information about survival. So we use this term auxiliary variable. And auxiliary variable has also been used in survey sampling. That's where I think the term originally appears. People also refer to these as markers, too. Markers, auxiliary variables, sometimes called surrogate markers, all different names for what I consider the same thing. In terms of literature, this is not quite chronological. It's not chronological, but Hina Malani proposed something, a modification of Efron's redistribution to the right algorithm. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that justification of the Kaplan-Meier using redistribution to the right. She used the idea of redistribution to the right to redistribute information to the right based on the value of people's prognostic covariate. That was her proposal. Susan Murray and Butch Theatis proposed what's called a weighted Kaplan-Meier, which is composed of, I'll show you what it looks like. It's composed of little, you calculate little Kaplan-Meiers like on each specific, on people with specific covariate histories, and you put them all together. And one thing about that is it has a maximum likelihood justification, a non-parametric maximum likelihood. Both of these approaches assume the marker is categorical, which is limitation, but it was a great start to think about the problem. And both are non-parametric. And it turns out they're equivalent, which is nice to know. So that's the way to Kaplan-Meier, which it looks kind of intimidating, but you can see up there to the left of the big product signs and summation signs, thetas. The thetas that happen to be the proportion of people who make it to a certain point in time who have a particular covariate history. And then you have over there all those S's. All those S's are Kaplan-Meiers that are estimated individually on people with specific covariate history. So you combine all this information into one estimator. So Frank, to simplify it, if Z, the auxiliary variable, is measured just once, say like it's a clinical trial where you measure it once a year into the study, or this general time, Xi, the way to Kaplan-Meier would look like this, for instance. it would be the product of the Kaplan-Meier estimated survival up to times I when the covariate is, when Z, the auxiliary variable, is measured for the first time, times this weighted product of Kaplan-Meier's here. And so you just have the proportion of people who live to this time who have a take on value 1 for this dichotomous covariate, and then the proportion of people who take on the value 2 for this dichotomous covariate, and you weight, this would be the survival of people who make it to times I and have the covariate value 1, or Z equal 1. This is their Kaplan-Meier, so on for that. And so you weight Kaplan-Meier's according to these proportions. That's why it's called a weighted Kaplan-Meier. Susan Marion Butchiatis generalized this test. They generalized their ideas into a two-sample test. They took they didn't take the log rank, but they took the Pepe-Fleming family of tests and generalized it just using substitution. So if you're not familiar with the Pepe-Fleming family of test statistics for comparing survival in two arms, you have an integral, and then you have a weight function, and then you have a difference of survival curves, which it turns out to be Kaplan-Meier curves. And what they simply did is they substituted for the Kaplan-Meier curve in that weighted integral, their weighted Kaplan-Meier. And in so doing, they get a more efficient test. So their version of the Pepe-Fleming test is more efficient than the usual version of the Pepe-Fleming test, if in fact the covariate is prognostic. If it's not prognostic, then it's equally efficient. Multiple imputation. Doctors Fawcett, Shanker, and Taylor, that's Dr. Taylor over here, they worked on an approach of using multiple imputation, and this is a general approach. So you could go with this approach to generate survival curves or two-sample tests or hazard ratios, and it's probably the most direct approach and most intuitive. So what you do is you for a person who's censored and has this particular covariate history, you impute what their survival would be. So the first step would be to actually build models for survival given a covariate history, and then to use those models to multiply impute survival for those subjects who are censored. So thus you create data sets that have no censored subjects, and use methods for multiple imputation to combine them. And chronologically speaking, the first approach that was used was that of Jamie Robbins, who will be speaking next. Although I don't think he's speaking on this topic, but I think this topic is old to him now. But his was a general approach too, and dates back to 1992 and work he began with Andrea Rudnitsky. So the general approach, including estimation of survival curves and two-sample tests and hazard ratios. And the interesting thing about their approach, it's based on modeling the censoring distribution. So with multiple imputation, you model the survival distribution in terms of the covariates. Here you model the censoring distribution in terms of the auxiliary variable, the covariates. And the way these work is that you rewrite all the usual tests, the Kaplan-Meier or the log rank or the hazard ratio, estimating equations, whatever you're interested in. You rewrite them such that at each time of event, in each risk set, you reweight people's contribution to the statistic or partial likelihood. You reweight them in inverse proportion to the probability of censoring given their particular marker history. So this is just an example, and I'm not using the same notation. I'm not sure I am that Jamie Robbins used, so I'm sorry for that if it doesn't look familiar. But here, for instance, is an estimating equation for thank you, Mikhail. An estimating equation for estimating the log hazard ratio, beta, and if we were not using IPCW or inverse probability of censoring weighted, you wouldn't see all this K notation. It just it'd be without that. But with the IPCW approach of Robbins and Rudnitsky, you introduce these these probabilities or likelihoods, which are based on, so for instance, this here would be have to be the probability that this person would have been, that subject J with covariate, or subject J with covariate history ZJ would have been censored at this particular time of event. And so that's, it's a probability that it would have been censored by that time, and you weigh inversely proportional to that. And you do it at each, so it's certainly like a second order type of thing, like you see like there's two levels of it. There's over not just here, but it's here in each, at each risk set, you have to redo this. You have to calculate these weights. And Robbins showed that this approach is more efficient than the Kaplan-Meier and the log rank and the hazard ratio, doing it the usual way. And what's really interesting and intriguing about this approach is that you need the estimated the estimated probability of censoring. So if you were to insert the known distribution, it actually would end up being less efficient than if you actually use the estimated distribution, which is very intriguing, and I can't say I understand how it works. It's still a wonder to me. So for instance, if censoring was not related to the covariate in question, the auxiliary variable Z, then it turns out if you were to insert the known distribution, basically you would be you'd be reducing to the usual Kaplan-Meier and log rank and hazard ratio. But if you insert the estimated distribution, you're actually going to get more efficient statistics. My emphasis has been on the whole question of efficiency. So can you increase the efficiency of a clinical trial? But I failed to mention up to now, and this is the only time I mention it, but these approaches were developed for another reason. For instance, Robbins developed this whole inverse probability of censoring weighted approach in order to correct for informative censoring. So, for instance, informative censoring would happen in a study if you had a prognostic covariate which was also related to the censoring process. In that case, the prognostic covariate would cause informative censoring. So Dr. Robbins developed his inverse probability of censoring weighted approach with this in mind. And so all these approaches I'm talking about have the dual purpose of being able to correct for informative censoring. So not just the IPCW approach, but the weighted Kaplan-Meier and the multiple imputation approach all can do this as well. So it turns out that a condition for consistency of these estimators is now, it usually when you're working with Kaplan-Meier's and the usual log rank test and Cox's hazard ratio, we assume that the survival is independent of censoring. Here it's not necessary to make that assumption. What you have to do is make the less stringent assumption that survival and censoring are independent given a covariate history. So the covariate might cause informative censoring, but if it explains all of the informative censoring, then you can still get consistency using these approaches. And the nice thing for me is that all these approaches, of which are derived from different directions, the weighted Kaplan-Meier, which to me has a maximum likelihood kind of derivation, the redistribution to the right algorithm, and the IPCW approach of Dr. Robbins. If they all end up being equivalent if the marker is categorical, and there's a little caveat to that with the IPCW approach, but basically they end up being the same. So for me, what's the starting point? The starting point was I started thinking about these before I knew about multiple imputation and IPCW. I was asking, is there a simpler approach? And that's actually, probably not fair, because I think multiple imputation is probably a very simple approach to take. It's very direct. The IPCW approach, for me, is not the simplest approach, because there's you do have to have this two orders of reweighting. The weighting is done like on two levels, and to me, that's not the simplest approach, although it does work. And Mike, and the question I have is what is the most efficient use of auxiliary variables? So the approach that, when I thought about it, that I took was began, for instance, with the proposition like this. Any k-sample statistic, like a log rank, or if you're estimating a hazard ratio between two groups, and it's based on right sensor data, can be written in terms of Kaplan-Meier statistics. So any two-sample statistic has, you can actually write as building blocks that consist of the Kaplan-Meier estimate of survival in each of the arms. So go and estimate the Kaplan-Meier in each of the arms, and then go and estimate the Kaplan-Meier of censoring in each of the arms. And with just those alone, that's like a sufficient statistic. You capture all the information. You can write for any k-sample statistic. So for instance, the two-sample log rank, you can actually equal to, you can actually write like as an integral of this. So this would be the number of people in arm zero, the placebo arm, for instance, the estimate of survival in the placebo arm, the Kaplan-Meier estimate of censoring in the placebo arm, and so on for arm one, and then you get these differences over here. This corresponds to increments for like the mass points of the Kaplan-Meier curve in arm one, and the increments or the Kaplan-Meier or the mass points in the Kaplan-Meier in the placebo arm. So that was my first. That was my approach. Was write these two sample or k sample statistics in terms of the building blocks of the Kaplan-Meier, and then substitute, for instance, weighted Kaplan-Meiers or other more efficient survival curve estimates that use information from markers. So to incorporate information from markers into a test or estimator, what you do is you write the test statistic as just like a series of all the Kaplan-Meiers of survival and censoring in each of the arms, and then what you do is you insert the survival curve estimates that incorporate prognostic information in there. So S1 becomes S1 star. So this, by the star I mean that it's a more efficient estimate. That's what I'm using in the notation. Is stars signify the survival curve estimate that's taking advantage of the prognostic information. So S1, the Kaplan-Meier for group one becomes the weighted Kaplan-Meier, for instance. These you leave the same. If there was informative censoring, then you would not leave the Kaplan-Meier estimates of censoring the same. You'd change those two. But if you don't suspect informative censoring, there's no need to change. And it turns out that these functionals are more efficient than the usual version where you have the Kaplan-Meier in there. So like as I was saying, choose for S star the weighted Kaplan-Meier, or another similar maximum likelihood estimator, or for instance the survival curve estimator of Dr. Robbins using IPCW. And Mikhail and I just had an article about this published in Canadian Journal of Statistics. So this gives you an idea of so for instance, this is not something that'd be done very often. But if you're estimating like a single parameter for a survival distribution, it turns out you could write the maximum likelihood score equation just like that on top in terms of the Kaplan-Meier estimate of survival and the Kaplan-Meier estimator of censoring up there. But what you do here is you take the Kaplan-Meier estimate of survival and you replace it by the estimate of survival that uses information from markers. That's an example. Another example is this would be how you'd estimate the hazard ratio. So this would be the score equation for estimating the hazard ratio from some like two-sample or k-sample study. So you have you sum over the studies and the size number of subjects in each study, and you have these integrals. Actually, I leave that out here. But what happens is that whereas in the Cox's version, this would just be the Kaplan-Meier estimate. Here you replace a weighted Kaplan-Meier or a more efficient estimate of survival. And the thing I like about this approach is that the implementation is very easy. You can, for instance, use R or Stata, whatever package you like to use. And most of these packages, you can specify weights. And the weighting here is different from the IPCW approach because in the IPCW approach, you couldn't readily use like the R versions or Stata versions. You would have to go a little deeper. But here you could just use it at face value, those programs, and insert... so what you do is you go ahead and you calculate your estimated survival, which takes into account prognostic information, and you go and calculate these weight. You're going to reweight each subject in the study. So typically, each study is weighted by the same value, like for instance 1 or 1 over n. You're going to recalculate the weight that each study contributes based on the following. So for instance, the subject who has an event at time I is now going to be weighted by what it turns out to be the increment in the survival curve estimated using the prognostic information times the survival curve estimate of censoring. These weights are very easy to calculate, like you know one line of code in R. And so if these were just Kaplan-Meier estimates, the stars were here. It turns out these formulas would all correspond to the value 1 over n. But when you use the weighted Kaplan-Meier, when you use a substitute of survival curve estimate that takes into account prognostic information, they're no longer 1 over n. Now, it's easy. Well, you can get, for instance, the estimate, but to get the variance, that's another story. But to get the estimate, that's readily done. Results and efficiency, doing simulations, which report in this article in Canadian Journal of Statistics. The efficiency gains can be up to 20%. So what does that mean? It means, for instance, that potentially you could design a clinical trial that had 20% less subjects. And what are the conditions for this? Well, the marker has to be highly prognostic. So, for instance, a dichotomous marker for which the high-risk subjects are at 5 to 10 times more risk than the low-risk subjects. And it only seems to give you these efficiency gains when you have censoring rates in the 60 to 80% region. So that's what we reported in this recent paper. I've been doing a little bit of work recently with incorporating continuous markers or continuous auxiliary variables to increase efficiency. So to give you a simple example, again, suppose the auxiliary variable, which is continuous, is measured one time, say at 1 year into the study, or times I. Suppose that you've modeled the data and you're willing to assume that survival following times I, the time at which that auxiliary variable is measured, suppose you're willing to assume that it follows a proportional hazards distribution. You might model it further and find other models. But for instance, if you were to assume that survival following times I, given the auxiliary variable, and actually I'm using an X here, but I should actually be using a Z. I'm not following notation. Suppose that you were willing to assume a proportional hazards model, then an efficient estimate of survival that's more efficient than the Kaplan-Meier estimate would actually be this weighted sum. So it's kind of like the weighted Kaplan-Meier, just taking it a little further. So you estimate the beta for using Cox model for the effect of Z on survival, and you estimate the cumulative hazard function, and so basically what you're doing here is you're getting survival curves for each subject. This is like predicted survival curves for each subject, given their Z, and again, this should be a Z, not an X. So you're getting predicted survival curves for survival following times I, when XZ was measured, and then you're just going to weight over them. You're going to sum over them to get a weighted estimate. And it turns out this estimate is going to be more efficient than just the Kaplan-Meier alone. And it's And you can argue that this is a semi-parametric maximum likelihood estimator, because that's how you build it. This is a maximum likelihood estimator, or maximum partial likelihood estimator. This is the cumulative hazard estimator, which again is a maximum likelihood interpretation. And the summation over the subjects, that's actually corresponding to integrating with respect to the empirical distribution function, which again has a maximum likelihood interpretation, the empirical distribution function of the auxiliary variable. If you have multiple times of measurement, which is you always do with the longitudinal variables, then you can generalize this approach readily to combining them. So what you'd go and do is estimate the Kaplan-Meier of survival up to times I, the time at which the auxiliary variable is first measured, and then for each of the periods which psi is measured. So for instance, if Z is measured at 6 months, 1 year, 1.5 years, 2 years, you'd estimate survival in between the first two times of measurement, 6 months and 12 months, and insert this type of weighted estimate, and then do the same for the second period and the third period, and then just combine them all into one estimator. This is going to be unbiased, and it's going to give you a more efficient estimator. At least that's what some simulations are saying. So just to give you an idea of what the steps are involved in this approach, you model the longest, step one is to model the longitudinal association of survival given the auxiliary variable Z, and build a well-fitting model. If the proportional hazards doesn't work, then generalize it. If you throw in random effects, whatever it takes, build a well-fitting model. And then step two is to estimate in survival in each of those periods, like 6 months to 1 year, 1 year to 18 months, etc., by using these weighted estimates and string them together. And so you get so up to step two, you're going to get estimates of survival that are more efficient in each study arm. And then you have each of these more efficient estimates of survival in each study arm that you can then go ahead to step three and apply the functional formula I was speaking about for generalizing log ranks or Cox's hazard ratios. Now one thing which has always been a question is in which Jeremy brought up this morning is can we take advantage of information from previous studies about the association of the marker or auxiliary variable with survival? So far the approaches I've been talking about are all internal. Like they only capture the information, they're only taking advantage of the information from the study itself. But usually the whole reason that we have a prognostic covariate, because other studies have suggested, the whole reason we measure a variable in a study is that other studies have suggested that it is prognostic. So we usually have information from other studies about just how prognostic a covariate is about survival. So the question is, can we take into account some of that previous information? And that's something that currently I want to start working on. I've done just a few baby steps about that. So can we increase the information of survival even more by using some of this prior information to get more efficient estimates of the association between the auxiliary variable and survival? So what I'm going to do now, I only have like 10 slides left, is just some simulations I've been doing recently. And the setting for these simulations are a clinical trial, a two-arm parallel study. Survival is a primary endpoint. I'm assuming it's like a four-year study. We have 1 year of enrollment, and then after the last subject's enrolled at 1 year, you have three more subsequent years of follow-up. And I'm also assuming a 5% annual loss to follow-up. So these are the conditions for the simulation results I'm going to talk about. So primarily, the censoring distribution is uniform, caused by this type of design. It's uniform censoring, but there's also a little bit more censoring thrown in because of people who drop out for other reasons, for other reasons which are not due to ending a study. I'm going to assume in this study that a continuous marker was measured at 1 year post-randomization. Assume it has a bell shape, a normal distribution, and I'm gonna assume what I call an interquartile hazard ratio of 6. What do I mean by that? I mean that subjects in the 75th percentile of this auxiliary variable are at 6 times more risk than subjects in the 25th percentile. And this corresponds to, I don't know if, how many of you are familiar with the what's called the Kenton-O'Quigley R-squared of around 50%. The Kenton-O'Quigley R-squared is an attempt to create R-squareds for survival data. I'm particularly fond of it. So it turns out that when the hazard ratio was about, when this interquartile hazard ratio was about 6, that the R-squared is about 50%. And that's very high. So this covariate is explaining a lot of information about survival. And so these are just some of the steps I've been, some of the simulation results I've been getting. So let me walk you through this table. So I have different censoring rates, 50%, 65%, 75%, 85%. In all these studies, the sample size is about either 150 or 200, depending on the censoring rate. And here I compared the approach I've been working on to the IPCW approach in terms of efficiency. So here I calculate the efficiency. So what this is saying is that when the censoring rate is 50%, the inverse probability of censoring weighted approach increases efficiency by about 5% relative to a log rank test. And then the approach that I've been working on is increases efficiency by a little bit more, hardly much more, 6%. In the third column over here, I have what I've done. This is my baby step toward incorporating the prior information about the association of the auxiliary variable with Z, so information from outside the study. And here, so what I did to mimic that, and it's only an approximation, I have to work on this further, but at this particular step, I actually knew what the actual hazard ratio was. I actually knew what the association was between the auxiliary variable and survival. So as opposed to estimating it, I actually knew it, which I could do because it's a simulation. And in doing that, you get a little more efficiency, so it's 6% up to 11%. The final column is what the bound is, and it's much higher. So the maximum possible is the maximum possible gain in efficiency, which will result if you actually knew survival up to 4 years for everyone in the study. And I certainly cut it off at 4 years because if I were to say what the maximum the other column I could have been had in there would be what the efficiency would gain would be if you actually knew survival for everyone, if there was no censoring. And that would turn out being like magnitudes bigger. But I wanted to, in this study, limit it to 4 years because it's a clinical trial and there's only 4 years and you certainly can't know anything past 4 years. So I didn't want to unfairly compare these methods to the maximum possible. I wanted to limit how much you could know. So if you were to know survival up to 4 years for everybody, you would actually be 64% more efficient than the log rank test. On the other hand, if you're down at 75% censoring, or up to 75% censoring, and you knew survival for everybody up to 4 years, you'd be more than twice as efficient, or 130% more efficient than the log rank. The inverse probability of censoring weighted approaches, that in that case is 8%. The functional approach based on that weighted survival curves that I was talking about gives you an efficiency of about 15% more. If you actually incorporated the prior information and knew exactly the association between survival and the endpoint, then it's 19%. So these are all from simulations, and the findings for me would be if your marker is highly prognostic, and this was a highly prognostic marker, and the censoring rate is around 70%, these approaches increase efficiency by as much as maybe 15%. And at least in simulations, it seems to be that the approaches I've been looking at are a little more efficient than the IPCW approach. And I still have to incorporate the multiple imputation approach. That's the next step for me, because it might end up being more efficient than anything. So for me, the two questions I have is it enough? I mean, is there any reason to be excited about these possible gains in efficiency, 10%, 15%? Because, I mean, basically what you're doing is you're talking about the difference between p-values of 0.07 and 0.05. I mean, maybe it's just hair-splitting stuff. And would you write a clinical trial protocol replacing, you know, log rank tests by these more efficient tests if you were convinced that they worked but only increased efficiency by up to 10 or 15%? Would people redesign clinical trials? I'm skeptical that they would. I think the threshold would probably have to be higher for people to modify protocols to introduce them. And the other question I have is, can we get better efficiency? Because you saw back there that in the table that I showed that the bounds were a lot higher. So here, so it seems you can get a lot higher than we're getting. So that's the question I have. I think we can do better. And that's how I want to end it.
Thank you very much.